I was going to offer my closing argument for the election, but the ellipse was booked. So we decided this was the second best. It's much better. It's an honor beyond what I can imagine, both to be part of this special dedication from the Schiller family, and to be in this new space and in this moment, and to have a chance to reflect with you a little bit about Sifrei Torah. So you have maybe one to two, at least the folks in the seats, some sources that I'll refer to throughout the talk, but even if you don't have them, it's not critical. You should be able to follow. Torah is a paradox, and there's no greater manifestation of that paradox than the scrolls in which we write it. Torah is at once davar v'hipucho, a thing and its opposite. It is the particular treasure of a particular people, the wedding gift, as it were, of God to the Jewish people. Some of our sages lean into words we just read a few days ago on Simchat Torah. Torah tziva lanu Moshe, morasha kihilat Yaakov. We just sang them out in the street. The Torah was commanded to us by Moshe. It's an inheritance to the community of Jacob, and they emphasize lanu morasha velo lahem. It's our inheritance, the inheritance of the Jewish people, and not a general gift to the world. And yet other traditions tell us that the Torah was spoken to the Israelites and written on the great stones of Mount Ebal in 70 languages, Ba'er Heitev, to prevent anyone from any nation speaking any language from claiming that the Torah's wisdom and vision was inaccessible to them. Hare Keter Torah Munach, the crown of Torah lies there, available to all. Torah is on the one hand the record and memory of revelation, a faithful attempt to preserve an eternal, unchanging divine will. Eile ha-mitzvot, ein navi rashai lechadesh od davar me'ata. These are the mitzvot. No prophet is authorized to innovate anything from here on. But also, in rabbinic tradition, the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, is the anchor and jumping-off point for Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, which carries that revelation into the uncharted territory of the Jewish future. Moshe, we are told, sitting in Rabbi Akiva's academy, cannot understand anything that is being spoken there because so much has been innovated in the rich discourse of later generations. The Sefer Torah that we dedicate tonight carries in its physical form this paradox of a book whose influence we wish to be limitless, even as its very form works at cross purposes with that lofty goal. And I want to take you through a few elements of the history of these unique containers for the words of the Torah and suggest how they capture our effort to manage those competing truths. And then we can reflect on how our Sifrei Torah teach us to think about Torah and life and history more broadly. So the first thing anyone familiar with a Torah scroll will tell you is that it's written in Hebrew. But that need not have been the case. The Mishnah states, Ein bein sfarim letfilin u'mezuzot, ela she'asfarim nichtavim b'chol lashon, u'tfilin u'mezuzot einan nichtavin ela ashurit. There is no difference between the protocols for writing Torah scrolls and tefillin and mezuzot, except for the fact that Torah scrolls can be written in any language, whereas tefillin and mezuzot can only be written in Hebrew. Literally, Ashurit, Assyrian script, the Hebrew block letters that we think of as the quintessential script of the Torah. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, af basfarim lo hitiru sheyikatvu ela yevanit. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, even with Torah scrolls, they only permitted them to be written in Greek or Hebrew, but not other languages. Now, when you think about it, how can the Torah be a potentially universal document if it can only be written in the language of the Jews? Tefillin and mezuzot, those are obligations incumbent only upon Israel. The parchment in them sits passively. They're never read aloud, and they're covered up. So those can, without much risk or loss, be restricted to a particular tongue. But the Torah, read aloud and publicly, if it's to be in the tradition of Ba'er Heitev, being well and broadly expounded, you've got to be able to read it in every human language. And even Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah concedes that Torah scrolls must be able to be written in the language of the empire, in Greek, so that its reach and impact will be no less extensive than that of the Jews' imperial overlords. The anonymous position of the Mishnah here, that of course the Torah, even in its ritual usage, can be rendered into other languages, seems to have been the intuitive practice of a number of Jewish communities. It's hard to know whether the diaspora communities of Alexandria in Egypt actually produced ritual scrolls of the Torah for use in the synagogue written in Greek, but they treated the legend of the commission of the Septuagint as a sacred narrative. And many in that community, including Philo, studied and engaged with the text virtually exclusively through translation. The Novellae of Justinian in the 6th century reports a long-standing dispute among the Jews as to whether the Torah should be read in Hebrew or in Greek, and specifically attests to a diversity of practice on the ground. And in Ethiopian Jewish communities, the Torah was ritually read from texts written in Ge'ez, with all connection to the Hebrew original being lost for centuries. This approach could have been taken by many more of our ancestors, and we could be dedicating a Torah scroll today, as odd as it sounds, that was written in English. In fulfillment of our mission to make Torah, even in its most sacred ritual forms, readily accessible to all. I don't need to tell you that that was the path largely not taken. The vise begins to close tightly and quickly on the Mishnah's linguistically expansive view. First, Rabbi Yochanan in the Talmud, as part of his general preference to rule like Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel in almost every case where he appears in the Mishnah, eliminates the possibility of writing Torah scrolls in any languages other than Hebrew and Greek. Rava, responding to a text that seems to invalidate any Hebrew biblical text written in another language, claims that the Mishnah's permission to write texts in other languages was only a permission to transliterate them into Hebrew characters. Imagine, if you can, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And Rambam closes the door entirely when he says that though it is technically permissible to write a Torah scroll in Greek, based on the Talmudic law, kvar nishka yevanim min haolam v'nishtabesh v'avad. Lefichach en kotvin hayom ela ashurit. The Greek language discussed in the Mishnah has already disappeared from the world and become corrupted and lost. Therefore, today we only write in Hebrew. Say, incidentally, if you ever took, let's say, reading knowledge of Greek for a PhD, and then went to Greece and tried to use the words that you learned, you would understand the depth of truth of the Rambam's point here. Even the translation of the Torah for non-ritual purposes was contested in various times and places. An unbelievable testimony from Rabbi Yoel HaLevi in 12th century Germany, who was confronted with a convert who did not know Hebrew and who wanted a Latin copy of the Torah so he could understand it. Rabbeinu Yoel HaLevi refused to authorize the translation, denying the convert an essential companion to the inaccessible original in order to stay faithful to the notion we only write the Torah in Hebrew. Now, that more extreme position on translation, largely lost, you can witness the Chumashim of every denomination today. We want the Torah to fulfill its destiny of being munach, lying there, available to all. And yet, when it comes to a Sefer Torah, no one has seriously entertained writing one in a language other than Hebrew since the Middle Ages. Now, when we move from the language to the materials used for a Sefer Torah, we find a similar trend. Remember that it was once the case that almost everything of significance was written as a scroll on parchment with black ink. When rabbinic texts specify these technologies as essential for sacred writing, they're not really saying something that different from a contemporary demand to put a resume on acid-free paper, store it in a low-humidity environment, and use 12-point font or greater. And as new technologies emerged, there were some who moved to embrace them. The codex, what we know of as the book, was developed as an alternative to the scroll in the early centuries of the Common Era. And Christians in particular seem to have been enthusiastic early adopters. Ethiopian Jewish communities read those Ge'ez texts from codices as well. And I even learned this morning that there have been sessions at the National Chavura Institute where Torah was read in one of the minyanim from a laptop as part of the ritual practice. Those instincts are, at root, good ones. And again, there's broad consensus today that the Torah should be widely available in whatever formats people can access. You can find the Torah in print, online, in translation, with an unending number of commentaries, and the ability to mix and match them with all the tools of our digital age. That's as it should be. Ba'er heitev. Use all the tools and technologies at your disposal to get the voice and message of the Torah out to the entire world. But when it came to the ritual object of the Sefer Torah, all Jews, other than a few exceptions that I mentioned above, stuck with the scroll, slowly turning the leading writing technology of the day into a nostalgic, artisanal form. Masechet Sofrim, the first classic normative primer on the scribal arts and hailing from the early Middle Ages, a time when the codex had already become overwhelmingly dominant, assumes the ongoing use of scrolls and ascribes many of its stipulated required details to oral traditions going back to Moshe. Later, other technological innovations vied to replace the scribal arts. The printing press allowed for the production of texts at scale and with economic efficiency. Why couldn't an ink-covered set of type simply be manually pressed by a sofer onto a properly prepared parchment to generate the text of a few columns of Torah text all at once? It might surprise you to hear that Rabbi Menachem Azaria of Fano in Italy permitted just this, and not a small number of later authorities cited him approvingly, including Rav Yaakov Emden. Nonetheless, Rav Yoel Sirkis and many other authorities rejected this innovation, insisting that ktiva, writing, was something that had to be done by hand, letter by letter. This position won the day on the ground, keeping scribes in business. A final round of revisiting happened in recent decades when Rav Yitzchak Abadi, a posek in Lakewood, attempted to advance the option of silkscreen printing technology, which also would have facilitated a less expensive and quicker option for creating Torah scrolls. And though the arguments for the validity of such scrolls are quite strong, at least in my view, and a few Sifrei Torah and Megillot have been produced of that sort, there has been strong resistance from other quarters. Poskim like Rav Ovadia Yosef and Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv emerged as unwavering opponents. And so we see here a second example of an effort to make Sifrei Torah accessible, losing out. My final example is perhaps the most surprising. We saw that Sifrei Torah can, at least in theory, be written in Greek. And even though the Rambam discounts this possibility, he only does so by saying that the Greek of old of which the Mishnah spoke is no longer truly a living language. But this theoretical flexibility to write a Torah in the right kind of Greek would seem to establish without any doubt that there's some leeway with the characters that are written on the parchment as long as they convey the content of the Torah. So why not make the text a lot clearer, a lot more accessible, and even more accurate by adding vowels? And perhaps the cantillation notes as well. That really would have made your job a lot easier. Anyone who has read Torah knows that's the real skill involved. The slightly forcocked memorization of an enormous amount of essential information which we don't even put on the page. You correct a guy, you didn't even give him the information in the first place. This idea, when you think about it, seems so useful and so not at odds with the core rules of writing the Torah that it's hard to imagine what could be wrong with it. And yet we find in Masechet Sofrim the following unambiguous ruling. Sefer HaMinukad lo yikrabo. One may not read from a Torah scroll with vowels. Afal pi shegorer et hanekudot shebo lo yikrabo. And even if the vowels are removed, one may not read from a scroll that ever had vowels put on it. Note that remarkable claim. It's not just that a scroll with vowels is invalid, but it remains invalid even once those vowels have been removed. There's something apparently, according to this text, so fundamental about writing the Torah in its pristine Hebrew script, letters alone, that any scroll that even has a history of being written otherwise is unfit to be used in the synagogue. The scribes who wished to act this way, and some who clearly did, were clearly responding to a need, expressing a desire to allow more people to read their holy Torah with greater ease. But this course of action is rejected, and this restrictive ruling is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. I think we can posit that this text minimally accords with that view of Rava that only Hebrew characters can be used to represent the Torah's content, probably goes further, rejects the entire tradition of writing the Torah in any other language. But putting that specific question aside of where it fits in that history of debate, what's so terrible here? Why would it be bad to make the text of the Torah clearer, to enable more people to pronounce it properly and with greater ease? We are not the first to ask that question. And I believe the answer offered by the Rashba 700 years ago is a key to unlocking the mystery of these repeated rulings and reluctances that wittingly or unwittingly prevent the Torah, at least in its most sacred form, from spreading and being accessed more widely. In explaining the ban on marking up a scroll with any marks beyond the letters themselves, Rashba states, "She'ein lanu ela kinetinato misinai, v'im nakad pasul, shekama dorshin chachamin amikra v'hamasoret, v'im ata menakdo ein kan masoret." Says the Rashba, all we have is how it was given at Sinai. And if you vocalize it, it is invalid, because there are a number of midrashim that depend on the distinction between how something is read and how it is written. And if you vocalize the text, you lose the way that it was written, which might suggest a different meaning than how it is conventionally read. Think about the difference between words like chalav, milk, chelev, fat, and the way in which the same letters are on the page. But you have to think about what the vowels are, and there might be multiple meanings hiding behind those characters. The Rashba argues that there are two issues with a vocalized Torah scroll. First, the scribal preparation of Torah must preserve all details of the form of the text that was delivered at Sinai. Any change from how it was done in the past, outside of very specific and limited areas of flexibility, causes rupture with this past. Second, the text of the Torah is deliberately and ideologically written without vowels in order to preserve its potential multivocality. The work of Midrash often plays with the ambiguity of the unvocalized text to allow various meanings to live alongside the conventional reading. One person's clarity, says the Rashba, is another's midrashic straitjacket. The vowels are simultaneously too liberal an innovation and too conservative a limit on the text. Now, there's actually more to the first answer of the Rashba, preserving as it was at Sinai, than meets the eye, and maybe even a bit of sleight of hand. Because Rashba knows that the Talmud explicitly tells us that the text we see in our Torah scrolls today is not identical to what was used in the past. In the Talmud in Sanhedrin, we hear, said Mar Zutra, and some say Mar Ukba, Batchila nitna Torah liYisrael bichtav Ivri velashon haKodesh, Chazra v'nitna lahem bimei Ezra bichtav Ashurit velashon Arami. At first, the Torah was given to Israel in ancient Hebrew script and in the holy tongue. Later, it was given to them in the days of Ezra in Assyrian script, the Hebrew block script used in our Torah scrolls, and Aramaic. Israel chose the Assyrian script that we use today and the holy tongue, the Hebrew language, and left Hebrew script and Aramaic for common use. The Talmud reveals to us that the iconic letters of our Sifrei Torah, what we imagine when we paint that picture of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradion ha'otiyot porchot, they would not have been familiar to those living in the time of the First Temple and earlier, a fact we now also know from extensive archaeological finds from the Bayit Rishon period. There are not extensive archaeological finds from the Bayit Rishon period, but what there are, an extensive percentage of them display this point. And so, we have to take Rashba's statement at greater depth. What he must mean when he says, all we have is how it was given at Sinai, is that our relationship with writing Torah scrolls must preserve the experience of continuity and must shun the experience of rupture. Even when we know intellectually that we are living in a different era, when we know that Torah was once written with a different alphabet, we are firmly committed to the notion that we are simple heirs to and stewards of an earlier age. And so if the Sifrei Torah we inherited did not have vowels, we cannot introduce those vowels as if we have come up with a better, newer, more up-to-date way of receiving and transmitting Torah. And I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that the Rashba's two reasons go together and reinforce one another. Specifically, the more Torah is to be an enterprise of unending creativity, one that sees multivocality as an asset and not a threat, the more it must also be firmly grounded outside of its current moment, anchored in times and spaces other than our own. I want to suggest to you that this first part of the Rashba more broadly explains some of the curious conservatisms that surround Sifrei Torah, even beyond what the various halachic texts we looked at seem to prescribe over the centuries. Jews have wanted their Sifrei Torah to tap them into an experience of continuity, and they were prepared to pay a high price to achieve this goal. While Christianity galloped into a position of world dominance with a Bible in the vernacular, in a codex that was eventually printed and cheaply distributed to all, Jews allowed and insisted that their sacred scripture be housed in an increasingly quaint, technologically outmoded, and to many, indecipherable container that threatened to leave it in the Keren Zavit of the synagogue, accessible only to a small number of experts. It's almost as if the collective instinct of the Jewish people was to say, just give us a taste of antiquity, of an unbroken chain from the past, a sense that we too are standing at Sinai when we read our Torah, and we will feel like we have a morasha, an inheritance that we need to work to preserve. writing in other languages, on modern media, with greater annotation. All of these pull us away from Sinai and deprive the Sefer Torah of its greatest power, its tangible ability to transport us across time. But the second part of the Rashba reminds us that some innovations are dangerous not because they cause us to drift away from the past, but because they close off possibilities for applying the eternal Torah to the present and the as yet unknown future. The flattening of Torah is a risk parallel to its abrogation. We can never allow our awareness of rupture and desire to get it right to quash the creativity inherent in this tradition. The old letters must be capable of forming new words, and those that we need to speak today may or may not be our lexicon for tomorrow. And so, the Sefer Torah sits at the nexus of our quest for eternity, helping us to cultivate a stance where these scrolls remind us of how old we are, how in certain ways, nothing has changed. Even as the Sefer Torah must be housed in a synagogue, in a Beit Midrash, in a culture of learning that is always imagining anew how we might articulate its timeless message for timely purposes. We're blessed to be here this evening because of the generosity of the family of Martin Schiller, Zichrono Livracha, Menachem Mendel, Ben Mordechai, Vesara. Martin, at whose Levaya I was privileged to be present, along with Rabbi David Ingber, is described on the Me'il of our new Sefer Torah, if you caught a glimpse of it on the way in, with three simple phrases. Nitzol Shoah, Ba'al Tfilah, Ish Mishpacha, Holocaust survivor, a master of prayer, a family man. Nitzol Shoah, your husband, your father, your grandfather, went through the greatest rupture one can imagine. He lived through the hell of seeing the world of his childhood destroyed, watching an entire world turn its back on him and his people. His trials didn't end in Buchenwald, from which he was liberated at the end of the war. Not long ago, I was privileged to see some of his oral testimony, I mentioned this to you, Mark, preserved in the Beinecke Library at Yale University. And I watched him reflect on moving to America, where even his own Jewish classmates didn't believe his accounts of what he had seen and experienced, and teased him about it. He had entered a world that would barely let him speak about, much less live in continuity with his past. And yet, Ba'al Tfilah, a davener, someone who loved davening and its eternal words. Mark, you and I were privileged to spend many a Yamim Noraim davening together. And you shared with me your father's attachment to the line, Be'ein Melitz Yosher Mul Magid Pesha. Who, more than your father, knew that these words can no longer be said as he might have heard them in his childhood? The missing advocate was no longer a heavenly angel who might have pleaded for a righteous outcome as Israel waits to be judged. Instead, he must have, how could he not have, thought that this line referred to God himself, who had ceased to advocate for his children, abandoning them to cruel death and destruction. And yet, he davened, the old words taking on new meaning in a new context, giving us an experience of continuity through the rupture. That's what those who daven in Judaism do. We connect to the words of old, even when they no longer obviously make sense to us. And why? Ish mishpacha. If you are building and sustaining a family, if you are building a future, you must understand that eternity is a two-way street. You simply cannot build a future off the present alone. He was dedicated to his family, to their success and thriving, but also wanted them to be connected to the Jewish people, to Torah, to a Jewish history and past that could somehow energize its future. All human beings are said to be like destroyed Torah scrolls when they die. Martin Schiller was like a Torah scroll in this sense, a paradigm of stubbornly linking our future and our present to our past, even when the latter lives across oceans in space and eons of time. We are so privileged to have been granted the honor of honoring this man in this space and in our Beit Midrash. What he exemplified and what Torah scrolls stand for so well captures what we try to do when we learn and teach at Hadar. You could well describe our Torah efforts at Hadar with this motto from Yerushalmi Peah. Afilu masha talmid vatik, atid lehorot lifnei rabo, kvar ne'emar lemoshe b'sinai. Even that which a senior student will teach in the presence of her teacher in the future was already said to Moshe at Sinai. This is as marvelous a statement as I know of a culture that prizes innovation as an affirmation of that which was always true. Even if that truth was only discovered to be so many years into this multi-generational project. We, of course, all of us, live in a moment of rupture. After the Shoah, after a century where the anchors of the Jewish world largely shifted from Europe and Muslim lands to the two centers of North America and the State of Israel, we live in a moment of shifting realities around gender, a moment of rapid technological innovation, transforming our society at the pace of years and months rather than centuries and millennia. We live in a world of rampant secularity, where sacred traditions no longer compete with one another, but with consumerism, self-fulfillment, and self-advancement. Torah must win people's attention even before it has a hope of commanding their hearts. All of that requires many creative students of Torah to be involved in hora'ah, instruction for the moment, the kind of instruction that will look honestly at the present and figure out what the Torah has to say to it. But in formulating these hora'ot, we aim to speak in the dialect of eternity. We want our innovative readings that point to and come from the Torah's future to sound like they come from Sinai. Even more deeply, we believe that when we are insightful about Torah and grounded in it, those ideas truly do come from Sinai. Like Rabbi Akiva, we assume Moshe Rabbeinu may be lurking unannounced in this room whenever we learn. And he ought to see our efforts as the organic outgrowth of his own. A commitment to gender equality is not an accommodation to contemporary mores. It's rather an unlocking of the culture of broad and far-reaching obligation laid out in the vision of a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, a realm of priests and a holy nation. When we ask hard questions of Torah, it's not an indulgence of the skeptic without and within. It's a product of the religious conviction that chotamo shel hakadosh baruch hu emet, the seal of the Holy Blessed One, is truth. When we make Torah accessible to a broad audience, when we see all of Am Yisrael as our constituency, when we say to you truly and honestly, this is your yeshiva, come and learn in it, we are not chasing metrics or likes or growth. We're attempting to be honest to the Torah's vision that covenantal moments only happen when we can say, Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. You are all assembled here. This new Sefer will contain all these dreams and more. It contains our inheritance, our morashah, one we aim to fiercely protect and preserve from all dilution and corruption, one we aim to infuse with vitality and multivocality. It is truly eternal, ready to respond to any moment and never of that moment. Yehi Ratzon, that we will be worthy of this scroll and the words written in it, and that generations hence will point to this Beit Midrash as one of the many centers of learning that lent their distinctive voices to the Masoret, even as, if we have done our job, all they will really hear is our small part in the unified, majestic symphony of Sinai. Thank you for being here.